February 9th, 2006, and welcome to yet another edition of The Image Doctors, a special feature of Nikonians.org. I'm Rick Walker.
And I'm Jason O'Dell.
And welcome back.
We have the pleasure of being sponsored by Kingston Memory at www.kingston.com.
Imagine that.
Imagine that. They make compact flash, secure digital, as well as memory sticks for your computer. So check them out at kingston.com.
A couple things that we wanted to mention before we get into our topics. First of all, we do appreciate all the very positive feedback that we've received from people. It's really quite amazing. So if you do have some positive thoughts, though, one of the things that we would really appreciate also is that you vote for us at podcastalley.com. You know, put in some nice comments. Also, podcast411.com, same thing. And that'll help us with sponsorships, just like the Kingston Memory, and that helps us keep doing these.
Yeah, bandwidth isn't free, and
no.
We need to figure out
our time may be free, but the bandwidth isn't.
That's right. And another cool feature that some people have been asking us about is where can I find, you know, how do I know when your show is coming out? Well, right off the bat, just remember that you can always check podcasts.nikonians.org for the latest episode. We come out every other week on Thursdays. People are emailing us saying, why can't you be more frequent? Well, we'd like to be, but this is a compromise of our own schedules, so we try to do it. But one really neat feature, if you've got a MP3 player such as iTunes connected to the internet, you can subscribe to our podcast. If you go to the iTunes Music Store online through the iTunes application and you do a podcast directory search for Nikonians, you're going to find the Nikonians Talk Radio program, the Image Doctors, and our other podcasts. And you can click a little button right there that says subscribe. And then the next time you go online, or you can tell it to check periodically once a week or every day even, and it will find this podcast and automatically download it for you into your computer.
Yeah, it works great.
It works really good. And we're trying to up our download rate. Everyone is doing a great job. Those of you who are already listening, we thank you again. Tell your friends, tell your photographer friends about our podcast. It'll help make the Nikonians community look even better.
So the topics that we've got this time, as usual, we'll talk about some reader mail, some questions that we received from people over the last couple weeks. And then we're also going to talk about macro. That'll be our special topic this time. And we'll talk about a number of things on that front. And then finally wrap up with what's coming up in the next podcast that we'll do. Am I missing anything, Jason?
No, that's about the show for today. There's some news. Just before we get to our mail, I think we should probably, if you haven't checked out the Nikonians.org main page, the homepage, www.nikonians.org, you're going to be pleasantly surprised to find that the main page has got an entirely new look and feel. It's easier to navigate. It's nicer looking, a little less cluttered. For people who are new to the site, there's a guided tour feature. It's really good, and it also has our news page in there too.
And while a lot of people, you know, just go to the forums directly, that's a pretty common thing. It really is worthwhile to check that homepage periodically. Otherwise, you might miss some good things on the site, new reviews, just a variety of things. So check it out.
I bookmarked it.
Yep.
It's now my homepage that I start on.
That's a smart way to do it.
I used to just go to the forums, but now I go to our homepage.
Yep.
Another little update is we got some feedback from some readers and some listeners regarding the 18-200 VR lens that we talked about last week. And one of our readers was quick to point out that we forgot to mention that we screwed up. It won't be the last time, I'm sure.
Nope.
That the new 18-200 VR lens has a improved VR vibration reduction system called VR2, whereas the original VR was good for 3 stops of stabilization, VR2 is supposed to be good for 4 stops.
Yep,
so you get another
cool
stop. Very cool.
And also some really, there's more feedback rolling in as more people are using the lens. And one of the things that we're hearing it is darn good in terms of
that
sharpness.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
A friend of mine went out, a photographer, he is testing that lens, and he told me himself that he brought the 18-200 and a bunch of other lenses, and he figured he'd try the 18-200, and when it was time for him to do, quote, real photography, he would use his trusted pro glass. He says that he hasn't taken the 18 to 200 off his camera. He's been that impressed with the way it performs. So yes. It does sound like Nikon's got a winner on their hands with that lens.
So how many shopping days is it until Christmas?
Probably enough to save up for that lens for next Christmas.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one. We also had a listener question regarding where to purchase used gear. And I think in this case it was specifically lenses. But you know, let's talk about just used gear in general. I think one thing that we'll do is put a plug in for our own forum that we have, the I Want to Sell and I Want to Buy forums. Those work out really well. You won't find quite as wide a range of equipment options as you might find other places. But historically, I can tell you we've had virtually no problems at all. In fact, I can't really even think of any that have ever come up with people not being pleased with the equipment. The people that are members of our site are a good bunch.
That's
right. And that's one of the things that you can depend on. So that's a great place to look initially. eBay, you'll find people having very positive experiences with it and some people having negative experiences with it. I've actually had pretty positive experiences with it.
I think in eBay, the trick is finding somebody who's actually you can communicate with. And there are a lot of shops and a lot of potentially shady shops that sell through eBay. That's their store. And they will sell import items, list them as new. And, you know, if you're looking for used stuff, there's some really great deals to be had there, then you have to be careful. So just look out.
Just a few quick eBay tips for people. You know, definitely look at the person's track record. You know, what kind of positive comments they're getting versus negative, and what do the negatives look like? Do they look like valid things, or are they potentially invalid ones? You're better off buying something like a lens or a camera where there are a number of photos in the ad. That's usually a pretty good indicator that the seller is not trying to hold back something, hide perhaps a flaw or whatever. Good descriptions are another indicator. If the descriptions are pretty precise and really mention every possible issue with the lens, you're probably going to be in pretty good shape buying it.
Right. If they're willing to talk about a few small scratches, chances are there's only a few small scratches.
And don't hesitate to ask a question. The response that you get back is another good indicator. If they kind of dodge the question, you know, look elsewhere. So just some quick tips. But you can get some good stuff that way.
And there's a couple of retailers online that will sell. I mean, obviously your local camera stores will probably have some used equipment. Your selection may not be that great. But if you were going to look online for some used gear, I know some of the major retailers, the B&H's, the Adorama, they sell it. The one I particularly prefer is, and not to shamelessly promote any particular retailer over another, but KEH.com sort of has made their reputation as being the largest seller of used and new equipment. And if they give you you can trust their ratings. You can also sell your gear to them. You won't make a lot of money doing it.
You won't make a lot of money selling it to any retailer, though.
That's right. Yeah. But on the other hand, you'll get a check in the mail within a week or so, and you can unload some old stuff if you need to.
But they're very reliable. I've had good experiences with them,
too. If they say it's in excellent condition, it will be in excellent condition. You don't have to worry about that.
Yep, so good questions. Let's go to our main topic.
Our fun topic of the day.
Yeah, which is macro. That's always a really popular subject for people, especially when they're first getting into using an SLR, especially seriously. Yeah, it's fun.
It's fun.
It takes a lot of patience, though.
It does.
That's the thing that's always a challenge for me.
You know what the best thing is about macro, though, Rick?
What's that?
You can always find a subject.
That's true.
You know, it doesn't matter how cruddy the weather is. There's, you know, you can fool around with your macro and take up, you know, all of a sudden you go down and blades of grass in your backyard or something.
Right.
You've got a subject when it might otherwise be a boring day. Overcast days work really nice for macro,
that's
too.
That's true.
So, I mean, there's just a lot of things for subject matter. It's kind of endless.
A good tip is when the light gets a little bit dull and overcast, shoot closer. And macro is kind of the extreme on that. But it's really true. That's perfect weather for doing macro shots. So let's talk a little bit about macro in general, and some of the topics that Jason and I had in mind is we're going to talk a little bit about just how to get closer.
I guess we should define what macro really means, huh?
Yeah, let's do that first.
I mean, macro is close-up photography, usually at magnifications of one-half life size or greater. And by magnification, I mean the image projected onto the film mm-hmm. or to your sensor would be either half or fully life size. You mm-hmm. would say one-to-one, you know, full size right. on the film.
And I think maybe for today's discussion, let's stray away from the pure definition of what macro is and just say close-up photography. So maybe we'll get out a little bit further away, even a quarter life size.
Yeah, and that's yeah. decent. I mean, what you're going to find is that you're going to go out, and the way people discover macro is they see a bug or they see something that they say, hey, that'd be a neat picture of. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if an insect, let's say it's a grasshopper, is 3 inches long, that's a fairly large grasshopper, they take out their lens. The next thing they realize is that no matter what they do, even with their zoom lens, they're not getting that critter to fill the frame in any way.
Right.
And then they try to get really close to the subject, and they can't focus on it. And that they've discovered now one of the major limitations of most lenses, that they have what's known as a minimum focus distance.
Right.
It's where you suddenly can't focus any closer. And what macro does is there's an array of tools out there for us to get around that limitation and allow our lenses mm-hmm. to have a closer minimal focus mm-hmm. distance.
Yep. So like I mentioned, we'll talk about the mechanisms for doing it, and then we'll talk a little bit about how you can focus. We'll talk about focusing rails and other approaches.
Some equipment, mm-hmm. yeah.
We'll talk about depth of field issues because those are nasty
uh-huh.
with macro. It makes it pretty hard. Talk a little bit about subject movement challenges and wind and things of that sort. Then we'll talk about lighting, multiple ways of doing that, composition, and then we'll wrap up with just some ideas for where you can learn a little bit more about it. That sound good?
Sounds like a plan.
All right, let's hit the first one. How do you do it?
How do you get closer? Well, with a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the Lens Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not an advertisement for Lens Baby, but what I mentioned was is that when you want to, as you get closer to the subject, the way you focus closer is to move the front element of the lens away from the camera body. Mm-hmm. What you're doing is effectively that's called adding extension. You're making the lens, you're moving the lens away from the focal plane of the film. And the simplest way probably to do that with a macro setup is to use something called an extension tube. An extension tube is a metal bodied ring that has usually the appropriate lens mount for your camera. All the manufacturers have some form of extension tube. And so it moves physically moves your lens away from the camera itself. And that will allow you to reduce the distance that you have to be from the subject and still keep it in focus.
Mm-hmm.
And extension tubes they're easy to use. They come in a variety of sizes. They have two limitations. One is not a big deal. The other one could be a big deal, depending on what you're shooting. The major limitation that I find with any kind of extension tubes is that you lose infinity focus. Your lens is not going to be able to focus far away. So you might, let's say you reduce the minimum focus distance on your lens from 6 feet to 3 feet. Well, that's great for when you're up close, but then if you try to focus on a building 50 feet away, you're not going to be able to get it in focus. The other issue with extension tubes, which is, I think, very minor in these days, is something called light fall off. You start losing a little bit of light as you add extension. But with modern cameras, with through-the-lens metering, it's compensated for. You don't have to worry about it at all.
Now, the other thing that shows up a little bit more with extension tubes versus what we'll talk about in a minute, which is macro lenses, is that if you're using the extension tubes with a non-macro lens and you're trying to photograph something that's flat, think about postage stamps or documents, you'll find the edges aren't quite as sharp unless you really stop down an awful lot. And even then, they may not be crisp. If you're shooting flowers and insects, it's not that big a deal, really.
You won't notice
you'll get good results.
Now, extension tubes, Nikon makes an extension ring, or they call them extension rings.
Yeah.
There's a couple of different kinds. Mm-hmm. They have not updated their extension tube forever. since the
80s. Yeah, that's a shame, really.
Which is too bad, but that's just how it goes. Their extension tubes have no metering couplings and no autofocus couplings, so you're kind of on
your own.
Well,
they're the old metering.
The old metering couplings.
Yeah, so you can use them with things like a D200, a D2X, D2HS. They'll work. For that.
But just a little clunkier.
Yeah, they're a little bit clunkier.
On the other hand, they're really well built. Mm-hmm. They're strong. They're sturdy.
Yep. I've had the same set since 1985. So
there you go. Yeah. And then the other manufacturer of extension tubes that you'll read about a lot on the web is from Kenko. Mm-hmm. And they make they're not quite as sturdy as the Nikon ones, but they do have electrical contacts in them, and they do allow screwdriver focus for autofocusing, which may or may not be a big deal, depending on the kind of macro that you're doing. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about it in a minute.
Yep.
But it's nice that they have the AF contacts. I use the Kenko tubes with my 70-200 VR lens, and I will report from firsthand that both VR and the AFS focusing work when I'm using the Kenko mm-hmm. tube.
And one subtlety there, too, is that the lens that you're talking about is your 70-200, which is a G mount lens. You definitely want to use the Kenkos with that. The ones I was mentioning just won't work, even on some of those camera bodies I mentioned. So the Kenkos are a nice way to go.
And extension tubes are not expensive. There's no optics in them. They're just an empty tube. So mm-hmm. Get yourself. You can usually get them set of three, different sizes. The more extension you add, the closer you can get to the subject.
Now, the next way of getting closer on a budget, which is a great way to go when you're first starting out.
It's always important to keep your budget in mind.
Well, you want to see if you really like macro or not before investing a ton of money in it, because you certainly can. The next way is diopters, and they work differently. Instead of adding lens extension, they remove focal length. And so what you end up with is a shorter focal length lens with the same amount of extension, so you get a high magnification. So that's the other way.
For ignoramuses like me, what's a diopter?
It's either a single element or a two element lens, really, that goes in front of your regular lens, screws into the filter ring, and they come in differing strengths, and it just depends on the manufacturer. One thing I will say is get one of the diopters that are two elements. Nikon makes them. They're called 3T, 4T, 5T, 6T, depending on the strength and the filter ring size. Canon also makes some.
That's the one that I have.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. But, it's a good one, though.
The only reason why I bought that Nikon is because Canon makes theirs in a 77 millimeter filter thread.
Yeah.
And you don't. So, because if you did, I would have bought it from you.
Yep. That's the way to go for 77 millimeters. But the two element ones are a whole lot sharper, especially toward the edges. And they're not really that expensive.
Right. And the one that I have, I think, from the Canon one is called the 500D.
Right.
That's the two. There is a cheaper one. So if you see the two for sale, one's half the price of the other. In this particular case, you'll be better off for image quality getting the two element one. Yeah. Just stay away from the single element, the cheap ones. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, it does pay to get the higher price item.
Yeah. A popular inexpensive macro combination is using something like a 5T or a 6T. Those are the Nikon ones that fit on a 62 millimeter thread, and putting them on a 70-300 zoom. It works pretty darn well, and it's lightweight. If you already have one of those zooms, why not try it? It works very well for insects and flowers and things like that.
Are there limitations with using diopters, Rick?
Well, we already talked about edge sharpness. Even with the two-element ones, it's not going to be as sharp as a macro lens. You're confined again to a distance range, just like with the extension tubes. You won't get infinity focus anymore.
Right.
But they're pretty quick to go on. There's an advantage with them, though. There's no light loss, and we didn't really talk about that with the extension tubes, but you do lose some light with extension tubes, mm-hmm. and that doesn't happen with diopters, so kind of a nice thing.
I think with my 500D diopter on the 70-200, a diopter is described by the strength, how strong they are in terms of how much focal length they reduce. And so I'll just, again, by way of comparison, I'll talk about my experience using a 70-200 VR, which at 200 millimeters, well, at any focal length, that lens focuses down to about 5.5, 6 feet, just under 6 feet, I think. Mm-hmm. When I apply an extension tube, depending on the length of extension tube I use, I can reduce that down to maybe 3 feet, just depending on how much extension I add. But when I put on my 500D diopter, the minimum focal distance at infinity is, I think, 19 or 20 inches, something like that.
Yeah.
And that's as far away as you can be. So here's, I have sometimes run into the field where I can get wonderfully great macro shots with this, but I have to be within 19 inches of the subject. And that can be a problem because sometimes if you're approaching, say, an animal, like a frog, they can be skittish and you can't get within 19 inches of them. Mm-hmm. If you can, however, for flowers or anything like that, it's a great it's a great thing.
Everything's so, always a compromise.
There's always a compromise.
They're inexpensive, but you know, a little bit less flexible than macro lenses.
Yeah, and when you're ready to go true, you know, if you want to make macro part of your bread and butter photography, then the advice would be to get a dedicated macro lens.
Yeah,
it's going to solve all of these problems. And give you a lot of advantages over these other methods as well.
Now, what people usually struggle with a bit at first and even later is what focal length of macro lens to get and what brand to get. And
what do I do? Help.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the focal lengths first. If you look at Nikon and other brands, most of the macros, and I'm going to skip the really specialized ones, you know, for really, really high magnification photography, but most of them are in the range of around 50 millimeters on up to around 200.
Right.
And in the Nikon line, you've got a 60, a 105, a 200, and a lens that you can still find around new at times, certainly used, and that's the 70 to 180 zoom, which is a very cool lens that we'll talk a little bit more about later. In other brands like Tamron and Tokina and Sigma, you'll find similar focal length ranges. Right. And I'll tell you, all those brands are really pretty good.
They're awesome.
In the macro lenses.
Something about designing the optics for a macro lens, they have a very high standard for sharpness. I used to use the Sigma 105 millimeter macro. Mm-hmm. It was my first macro lens. It was sharp as hell.
Yeah, the Nikon ones are very, very good, you know, especially that 200 terms of sharpness, but honestly, all of those brands are pretty good. You'll just have differing standards of construction, handling, things like that, and it's best to try them out yourself and see what you think. But you can get good results with all of them. The big advantage with the longer focal lengths, the 105, the 200, the 70 to 180 to a certain extent, is working distance. And let's talk a little bit about what that is. That's not your focus difference distance, which is measured from your film plane or sensor plane out to your subject. What working distance is the distance between your subject and the front of the lens. And that's a pretty important thing because if you're working with skittish subjects like little bugs or things like that, or if it's just awkward to get close, then working distance will help. And with a 60 millimeter lens, you're not going to have much. You're talking a very small amount of working distance at high magnification.
Right.
So you're going to be right down that poor little bug that was screaming for help. And you may not have a lot of room to move things like flashes in and stuff like
that. And sometimes you don't want to be that close to your subject.
Yep.
Like, for example, you might want to take, like we said at the top of the show, macro doesn't necessarily have to mean 1/4 life size. It just means getting fairly close to your subject. Okay. I shot some photographs of a rattlesnake.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I was glad that I had
a
little
working distance.
Yeah, that's
one I don't
want
to get close to. So,
you know, so because I wanted a frame-filling shot of that, so I wasn't going to use a 50 millimeter lens and walk right up to the snake. I wanted to be able to be farther away. And use something in the 300 to 400 millimeter range.
Yeah. Now, if you're using a digital body as opposed to film, that helps in the digital realm. We won't go into all the details. The reproduction ratio stays the same, but the composition gets tighter, and so you can get by with a little bit less focal length if you're using one of Nikon's digital bodies.
Right.
But focal length helps. It's a nice thing. Now, we were talking earlier about the 70 to 180. That's a a very handy lens. I find myself using that more than any of the others, and I've kind of accumulated a few of those Nikon macro lenses.
I heard you accumulated some new lenses over the weekend too, but I won't go into that.
We could talk about that briefly maybe later. The 70-180 is really nice because it solves one of the biggest problems with macro work. And what that is, you're often wanting to shoot off of a tripod. You don't necessarily have to do that, especially with flash.
We would strongly recommend it.
It makes it a lot easier. Your arms get tired. It's difficult to get the subject in sharp focus. So you're often shooting on a tripod. And the problem is that you'll set it up in a position. You'll try focusing on your subject. You get it in focus, and you realize, well, the composition's not right. I want to get tighter, or I want to get further away. And then you have to shift your whole tripod. And it's until you've tried it, you don't realize how much of a pain it is.
I realize how much of a pain it is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the ways around it classically are to use a thing called a focusing rail, which allows you to shift your camera and lens assembly forward and backwards on your tripod. Those work well. But if you have the 70-180, you really don't need it. You can just zoom to change your composition, right, and it works really, really well.
Well, that brings, you know, your point about focusing rails brings up a good point. When mm-hmm. you're when you start getting very, very close to your subject, a couple of things happen. First of all, depth of field goes to hell in a handbasket.
Oh, yeah.
It disappears.
You
we'll talk about
no
that in
depth
a second.
Of field.
You basically don't have any depth of field.
Yeah.
So that means you have a very slim sliver of of a focus plane. And this has very strong impact on things like the way you're going to compose the shot, etc. But most of the time, if you've got a moving subject or a stationary subject, you have to deal with, you sort of got a two-body problem here. You've got a moving target and your lens can focus, which if you're using a macro lens, it's essentially moving the lens forward and backwards, closer and farther to your subject. You're going to get that plane of focus, you know, is that magical spot. The easiest way to focus on, let's say, a stationary subject is to set your tripod up at the distance that you want to achieve the particular magnification, set the focus on the lens and leave it there. Put your lens mm-hmm. on manual focus, leave it there, and then just by moving the camera assembly or your tripod back yeah. and forth a little bit until the subject is in focus, that works really well.
Yeah, it probably sounds non-intuitive. You have to trust us on it. It's
if you
by
get a
far
macro
the easiest
lens,
way to do it.
If you get a macro lens and you start using it in manual focus, my Sigma 105, you'll start to see the internal barrel starts extending farther and farther away from the film plane. It will have markings on it typically. It'll say 1:4, 1:3, 1:2. That's the magnification, which again is not that important, but you can set it at one of those marks and say, okay, for me to get this at 1:2, I have the lens set. And now I'm going to just move the camera assembly back and forth.
Yeah.
What a focusing rail does is it's a little track that mounts onto your tripod, onto the bottom of your camera, and it allows you to move usually with a kind of like a micrometer, with like a screw knob, the camera forward or back to make fine adjustments in focus.
Yeah. Yeah, and they work well. And you can find a variety of them, some that aren't too expensive, and they're ones made by Kirk and Really Right Stuff. Those are really nice things of beauty, but kind of expensive.
Right, and that's for you serious macro guys.
Yeah.
You could also take the converse approach, which is let's say you have a moving target. You can keep your subject distance more or less stationary. You know, plant your tripod down, and then just use the autofocus until you have the subject in mm-hmm. focus. The difference of that is that you're not really then controlling the magnification. The magnification will be determined by how far your subject is
right.
from you. But for like moving, flying insects, that can be a useful technique, like continuous autofocus.
Right.
Can help.
Yep. We talked briefly about tripods. They really can help a lot. One of the things that you want, though, is a tripod that allows you to spread the legs out really wide. There are a lot of them that do that. The Manfrotto tripods will do that. The Gitzos and other brands too. But look for that. If your tripod allows you to remove the center column and replace it with one of the flat plates.
Do it.
That's a good way to go. That's the way I have mine set up. And then you can get down to very low levels to the ground, which is what you want with macro. So that's the way to go.
There's also some specialty items that if you get there, Kirk makes something called a low pod,
yeah,
which you just attach a ball head or whatever to it, and it's, you know, it's just basically a plate. But that's getting pretty specialized.
Yeah, you can spend a lot of money on macro if you want to. That's for sure.
Like all photographic endeavors, you can blow your bank account.
Now, one of the challenges with macro is subject movement. Especially due to wind.
Oh, yes. Wind is the enemy.
Oh, it's a nightmare. And you might think it's a calm day until you start shooting macro. And then you see that little flower just bouncing around. And the wind is a horrible problem. Part of solving that is patience. You may have to wait a while for the wind to die down. And by waiting a while, we may be talking, you know, sitting there for a half hour.
Right.
Waiting for things to subside.
Here in Colorado on the Front Range, it's windy.
It is.
In fact, today the gusts are around 40 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And not a good day for macro, despite the fact that it's sunny.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that you can do, and you know, in a previous episode when we were talking about shopping ideas for Christmas, we talked about some of the 5-in-1 diffuser panels that are made by...
Photoflex makes
thank
those.
Thank you. Photoflex. Those work well in terms of lighting because they get rid of some of the harsh lighting around your macro subject. And if you're using one of the bigger ones, they'll also block the wind.
Right.
Now, they can also be kind of hard to hold on to if the wind kicks up. But when the wind isn't too strong, that is a good way to go, especially if you're out shooting with a friend.
Mirror lockup.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a friend to hold your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing you can do is there's a neat little clamp. It's called a PLAMP, P-L-A-M-P. It's made by Wimberly. And that's a little clamp. You can attach one end to your, say, a tripod leg or a tree branch or something. And then the other end of it is a very a fine little pincher clamp that you can use to hold stems or
yep.
little items in place, get them a little closer, move distracting elements out of the way. That's something you could do.
It also works for... holding that diffuser in place in some situations.
Yes, that's right.
There are ways of doing that.
It's just sort of a third hand that you can use. And it's a neat little articulated thing.
Yeah.
It's a little ball socket little guy. And
now,
they're not too expensive.
Yeah. Now, the other way of somewhat solving that problem is by using artificial lighting.
That's right.
Rather than natural lighting. And there are a variety of ways of doing that. Electronic flash is probably the most popular and the most realistic out in the field. You know, other lighting things are just too hard, except in studios.
I guess we should back up here for a second
sure.
and explain what one of the challenges. We said a few minutes ago that when you start getting the really close focus distance, the depth of field, it just disappears.
It does, yeah.
This means that for nice, sharp macro shots, you're going to want to shoot at f/16 or higher, probably even sometimes f/22. One thing to keep in mind is that this is where having a camera with a depth of field preview button comes in really handy.
Really handy.
Really handy, so you can just sort of judge the depth of field. It gets kind of tricky, but more importantly to our issue of lighting is if you start shooting at f/16, f/22. All of a sudden, you're dealing with slow shutter speeds in natural light. And most of us prefer to shoot at a lower ISO rating if we can get away with it. So that's one thing you can do would be to up your ISO. But the other thing you can do now is start adding artificial light.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens with when you, say, use a flash at f/16, the artificial light source becomes the primary light source for your subject. And because the flash is only in duration of real short time, it's going to freeze the motion. And even if your subject were to move a little bit, it wouldn't be recorded on your film or in your digital camera.
Typically, you're talking thousandths of a second in duration. So
even
that
if your shutter speed
motion.
Is at 1/25th.
Yeah.
So put your camera, this is where manual override on your camera can come in quite handy.
Mm-hmm.
Set the camera to f/16. A 60th or 1/25th of a second, and then use a flash.
Yeah. Now, there are a variety of ways of using flash. You can use your regular flash, like if you have something like an SB 600 or 800.
Or SB 28.
Yeah,
film.
It just all depends on what body you're using. Put it on an extension cord and position it, you know, fairly close to your subject. You'll actually get better looking lighting than you think, just because the size of the relative size of that flash when it's up close to the subject is pretty large. It's not a pinpoint source of light, and so it'll be a little bit diffused just because of that. You can also use that same diffusion panel I was talking about earlier in between your flash and your subject, and that'll kind of make things a little bit nicer too.
And if you have an SB 800, or it comes with a diffusion dome that you can mount on the front of the flash. That's another way. And then there's some third-party diffuser domes.
Yeah.
I think it's Stofen. It's called the Omni Bounce.
Right.
And that they make those in different colors. And you know,
there's a new Nikon flash that's out right now. It looks pretty cool for macro. I haven't used it, but you've done a little bit of research into it, right,
Jason? Talked to some people who've used it. We're now moving from spending more money on macro, we should say.
Yeah.
You're no longer going to use your universal speed light. You're now going to invest several hundred dollars on what we call either a ring light or a macro flash.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to be called ring lights because they would fit on the front on your filter thread.
And they were shaped like a ring.
So they were a ring.
They're not anymore, though.
They're not anymore.
They haven't been for a while, in general.
Yeah. The downside with the original ring lights was that you could tell when someone used them because catch lights would look like donuts.
Yeah, they were weird looking.
You know, weird catch lights.
And the light was too flat sometimes.
Yeah. But now
they were really made for dentists.
Open primarily. Up and say, I guess that would be a macro application I'd rather stay away from.
Yep, me too.
But there's some new TTL flash macro flash systems out, and the one from Nikon is called the R1C1, and it's actually a wireless system which sort of solves a neat little problem.
It looks very cool.
It looks very cool.
Very expensive.
I want to say it's pushing $700 or something. I don't know. But it's neat.
Yeah. You have to be serious about macro, obviously.
And these little flash units mount on a ring, and you can mount it. The kit comes with two flashes, which is useful for creating directional lighting. But you can also add more. And I think if you take it off of the camera, that ring will hold, I think, up to 8 of these little flash units, and you can really do some creative stuff with it. But it's ITTL. So you control it wirelessly through either a separate commander unit, or if you have a D200 or a D70, you can use your pop-up flash in commander mode and save yourself the extra expense of the unit. And the initial reports of this flash are that it's fantastic.
Yeah. Now, there's some older, cheaper options out there. There are some flashes called the SB29, the 29S, which was a little bit more for digital bodies, but it still was an ITTL. It just had a reduced intensity setting that worked better for higher ISO situations like found with DSLRs. And there's some older ones, too. They work pretty well, actually. You know, the lack of the ITTL flash is not as big of a deal as you would think. But the newer one is probably pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then the reason I mentioned, though, is people are selling those to buy the new one, so you might get a really good deal.
True, that is true.
Yeah.
And the nice thing about having a ring flash,
if you have a film body, you're set.
Is that the trickiest part about mounting my SB 800. Well, I can rig that up, and I got some flash arms that are articulated, and I stick that on there. But you're dealing with stuff that gets heavy, it gets awkward to use, and also it's sometimes hard to point the flash the right way. With a ring flash or with the macro flash, you don't have to worry about that because the flash is right on the barrel of the lens. So that subject is going to get illumination, and that light is going to bounce back into the camera, not somewhere else. And so it's going to give you a really nice, clean image.
Right.
We should point out that Sigma makes an ITTL.
I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, I have as well.
That's another option.
Too.
Now, the last area that we were going to talk about with macro is just composition.
Because
it's probably one of the more important things, right?
I'm compositionally challenged a lot of times.
Well, the thing is with macro, you're often so worried about all the other things that we were talking about. You forget about it because you're just kind of relieved to get those other things sorted out. But
Some I'm not of the even that old, and I forget about it.
Yep. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, the basic composition rule that I always forget, and it just goes with any kind of photography, yeah, is just remember your rule of thirds.
Yeah.
Macro pictures can get very cluttered very quickly. You want clean appearance. You want to put your subject, if you can, frame it in the picture using the rule of thirds.
Mm-hmm.
That's sometimes easier said than done because, like we were talking about, you may have a moving subject. Yeah. You might not be able to get your tripod at the right angle.
And it is a guideline. It's not a rule, but usually those bullseye compositions where you put the flower, the bug, right in the middle of the picture just don't work well. So the rule of thirds is a nice way to go. Get it a little bit off-center, and it doesn't have to be exactly a third. You want to watch your background elements.
Yeah, that's just a biggie.
And the danger is you were talking about shooting at f/16. And you do want to do that a lot of times so that your subject is sharp. But the problem is those out-of-focus elements in the background start getting more intrusive, especially if you're not using an artificial lighting source. And that's where you want to use your depth of field preview. I usually find that I don't use my depth of field preview so much to determine what's sharp as to see how unsharp the background is and how distracting it is.
Now, here's a neat little trick. This feeds back to what we started with, which is macro lenses of different focal length.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why you might want to use a 200 or 100 millimeter macro lens is that you are farther away from the subject. The angle of view is reduced, and it throws the background out of focus better, and so you can get those smooth backgrounds.
Yeah, and it's not even so much that.
You're isolating a smaller part of the background.
Yeah, at a specific magnification, depth of field is the same for every focal length lens. But it's just what you said. You can isolate that part of the background, that little section out there that has the right kind of colors, tones, and isn't distracting.
Some of the best macro shots are ones that just have that just dreamy, smooth, uniform color, maybe a gradient, but you know, they don't have a lot of blotchy things. Hey, sometimes that's impossible to avoid. You know, there may be branches or something, and it's either that or no picture at all.
But so that's where
always take the picture.
That's where that 200 or 180 millimeter macro just is wonderful. And you know, I'd have to say that in general, the macro pictures with those longer focal lengths are a little bit nicer, just in general.
Now, on the other hand, we don't want to knock the 60 millimeter macro because there are circumstances where you might not have the working distance to actually wiggle in there. Yeah. And so then you want, like in a field of flowers, where you might be very tight up against a rock or something like that, where you want to be able to get. So that's, you know,
it just depends.
So not to say that the shorter focal lengths are bad.
No.
It's just they're going to have a different angle of view, and you have to keep that in mind. The in my opinion, what separates the wheat from the chaff when I'm looking at macros, even though I don't do a lot of it, is backgrounds and then getting the plane of focus right. And so that's our third thing is the plane of focus. Let's say you're taking a picture of that butterfly. And what do you want to do? Well, if you can, if it's sitting there for you, if you can put your camera on an axis that's perpendicular at a right angle to the wing of that butterfly, you're going to get that whole butterfly's wing pretty much in the focal plane.
And if that's what you're striving for, that's the way to go.
And those are nice pictures. You know, so a lot of insects that works like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there's our rule about wildlife. We talked about getting the eye in focus, and that's good too. But, you know, that's where you're going to want to be stopped down. But if you can be the more, you know, or a leaf, let's say.
Yeah.
Say you wanted to shoot the pattern of venation in a leaf. If you're a little bit off on that angle, you're going to see that the leaf is going in and out of your plane of focus.
Yeah, and it makes a huge difference. It truly does. So having that plane of focus perpendicular is...
And that is why I'm not a professional macro shooter, because I never get that thing right.
Yeah, and perpendicular to the lens axis, parallel to the film plane or sensor plane. That's the way you want to go.
Yeah.
The last thing on this topic, we wanted to mention some good references if you want to follow up on it. One of the classic ones is John Shaw's book called Close-Ups in Nature. It was written or published back in 1987, so a long time ago. Some of the things discussed in there are a little bit out of date, but I'll tell you, it's still a wonderful book. A lot of great ideas.
And the photographs in there.
Photographs are fantastic.
Make me feel worthless every day.
And most of the topics are still accurate today. It's just there's some newer technology that's not really discussed. He's got a few newer books that are more general nature photography that touch upon the newer things. But for macro stuff in particular, this is still a great book.
And given that autofocus really isn't critical for macro work, 99% of what he says in his book is applicable, especially the composition stuff.
Yeah, the other thing for follow-up is look at our macro forum on nikonnews.org. There's a lot of good information there. A
lot of good shots being posted there.
Yep. Let's talk a little bit about next time, our next podcast in 2 weeks. That won't be our PMA one. That'll be the one after that.
Yeah, we're going to have a little special edition podcast from PMA in a couple of weeks. But our next regularly scheduled podcast, which, if I am correct, let me see what date we're looking at. That will be on the... Well, I guess we'll have one for the 23rd, right before the PMA show.
Yeah.
So our next regularly scheduled podcast on the 23rd of February. What are we going to talk about, Rick? Do you have any idea?
Well, by popular demand, we're going to talk about how to start out in photography.
The old beginner kit. What should I buy? Good idea.
So hopefully this will help people facing that situation right now. And it might give you some good ideas for advice to a friend that might be doing that, even if you're more experienced. So we'll talk about equipment, a little bit about composition, just basic things.
Exposure.
And for those people looking at digital, just a little bit of basic stuff on post-processing. Kind of like what are the three basic tips that will really help improve your pictures initially? Because there are a few of those. And we'll talk about that
next
time.
Most of them I've probably forgotten. So I have to study for next time. I have to remember these things.
Yep.
So, again, thank you for listening. We hope you subscribe to our podcast. And on behalf of Nikonians Talk Radio, thanks again for listening to The Image Doctors. And we will see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye. I'd like a million of your aura myself. I want a doctor to take a picture so I can look at you from inside.